A quick word from our sponsor, Freed. We all want a more efficient workflow, and Freed is an AI scribe that helps with just that. Freed AI not only listens, it transcribes and writes your medical documentation for you. And yes, it's HIPAA compliant. I use it regularly when I'm on service, and I have to say, Freed is a really intuitive interface, so it really seamlessly integrated into my daily workflow and routine. I think we all have our own particular way we like to write notes, and so what's great about Freed is that it not only listens, but it also understands and adapts to your unique style over time. So the sooner you start with Freed, the easier that your day could possibly be. Give it a try and see if an AI scribe fits into your workflow. You can use the code CORE50 to get $50 off your first month of Freed. Again, use the code CORE50 to get $50 off your first month of Freed. And with that, let's get into this episode.
Sometimes we think about hospice and we think, oh, well, this person's going to die in 6 months. You know, you ask anybody what hospice is, and that's probably what they're going to say if they understand even kind of a little bit about hospice. But what the nuance is that we don't really talk about or reflect upon enough is that you can't have the end of life and the challenges of the end of life without the joys of being alive. Like, they come together. We are born, we die. We exist in a dichotomy throughout our entire lives. So hospice is not just about dying, but it's about living.
That's Brianna Tobin, a music therapist at Good Shepherd Community Care and Hospice. And welcome to the Core I Am podcast. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi.
And I'm Dr. Mahathi Kumaragiri.
Both Mahathi and I are internists, and we are so excited to be joined by one of our favorite palliative care attendings, Dr. Harry Hahn.
Hi, everyone.
Harry, we are so thankful that we're doing this episode because I think as internists, we interface with hospice all the time. But if I'm being honest, I think most of us have a pretty superficial knowledge of hospice care.
Same. I get so many questions from my patients and their families about what will happen when they're on hospice. What does hospice even cover? And can hospice just happen in the hospital?
Mahathi, Shreya, those are great questions. And we have a lot to cover. So this is a two-part series on hospice. This first episode focuses on the nuts and bolts of hospice care. And I think it's important to understand how hospice is structured before we get into the more practical things that internists may face. This first episode is sort of like eating your veggies. You may not find it as enticing as the newest insert witty cardiology trial acronym, but it's important.
Yes. And then the second episode, as Harry mentioned, we'll get more into nuanced management choices after the decision of hospice is made. And I think it'll be good application of the nuts and bolts we'll cover today.
Yeah. So today we're going to get into number one, the philosophy of hospice. Number two, who qualifies? Number three, who makes up the hospice team? Number four, who pays for it? Number five, what are the different levels of care? And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, what are the limitations of the hospice benefit?
And some disclaimers, of course. So one, today's podcast covers hospice care in the United States in 2023 and 2024. And two, there's wide variability in hospice agencies across the country. So our hope is to give a general overview, but there may be some nuance with your local agency partners.
We also recognize we have a lot of loyal international listeners, and we would really appreciate if you guys write in and let us know, how does hospice in U.S. compare to end of life in your country? And just excited to keep learning more. All right, Harry, Mahathi, why don't we start with what actually is hospice and make sure we're all on the same page?
So hospice care is a philosophy of medical care that has been codified into an insurance benefit here in the United States. Instead of focusing on medical care that aims to cure or target disease control, hospice care focuses on comfort-focused care, focusing on things like pain management or symptom management. A major goal of hospice is to try to keep people out of the hospital, closer to friends and families at the end of life.
One thing that I always stress, especially if it's something that families are confused about, hospice does not mean the end of medical care. Nobody's giving up on somebody when they go on hospice. It's a shift in focus from quantity of life to quality of life. And a patient who comes onto hospice is still receiving medical care. It's comfort-focused medical care.
That's Roger Schrader, a social worker at Good Shepherd Hospice. And here's how Roger defines comfort-focused care.
It's not a decrease in the medical attention that they're getting. They're still getting it, but it's a comfort focus. And that it's a holistic approach to comfort. You know, it's what makes you emotionally comfortable? What makes you spiritually comfortable? What makes you psychologically comfortable? Like, how can we provide you a comfortable environment as you approach the end of life? And I think that's a side of hospice that doesn't get discussed as much because it's not as imminent. It's not as immediate. Like when somebody's at the end of life, you know, preserving their physical comfort is paramount, obviously. But also knowing that hospice goes out of its way to, you know, to address emotional and spiritual and, you know, psychological needs as well to ensure, you know, in a non like medicinal way.
Oh, I love how he brings in all the different aspects of comfort. And I really think that wording around emotional, spiritual, psychological, physical comfort will be helpful to have in our back pocket. Because I know so many patients and families have this idea that, okay, once the hospice label is there, they'll be left alone. They won't be cared for as much.
We're not saying, okay, you're on hospice. Here is your morphine and we'll be by in 3 weeks to see how you're doing. Take it as you need it. No, it's an increase in attention in some respect. You know, we don't hasten death. We don't slow it down either. We just approach what's going on moment by moment, whether it's like day by day, week by week, or hour by hour, or as somebody's, you know, actively dying minute by minute to ensure that comfort.
I really love that. I think I'm going to take this, we approach things moment by moment and how we're not hastening the dying process into my next goals of care discussions. It also just makes me realize how much upfront education we sometimes need to do when we're transitioning someone to hospice. And I just really appreciate restructuring how to think about this.
Okay. So now that we're all on the same page on the philosophy behind hospice, have some good wording to take to our next goals of care conversation, let's go over then who actually qualifies for hospice real briefly.
Yeah, so to get into just that, we sat down with Dr. Jillian Sutton, the medical director at Good Shepherd.
Now, Medicare will define a terminal illness as an anticipated prognosis of 6 months or less. So when someone comes on hospice, part of the criteria and definition, I guess you could say, is that two physicians certify that they have an anticipated prognosis of 6 months or less.
You know, to be honest, the two physicians thing really makes sense to me. We do such a poor job at prognosticating that having multiple perspectives will hopefully help with prognostication, especially when the life expectancy is less than 6 months if the disease takes its natural course.
Totally. I'm remembering an At the Bedside episode from 2020 on prognosis. The guest, Dr. Alex Smith, suggested using prognostic calculators and getting input from multiple clinicians actually improves prognostic estimates.
Yeah. You know, I guess one thing I get worried about, though, is like, say, despite using those prognostic calculators, say, getting good input from that second physician, be it the PCP or oncologist or palliative care doc, what if we estimate wrong, right? And say the patient lives longer than 6 months, you know, does hospice say sayonara?
So after those 6 months, they require a physician or a nurse practitioner to check in on them every 2 months. And it's easy for me to remember because I think about it that we anticipated they would have a 6 month prognosis, but here they are still alive 6 months later. So they want you to check in every 2 months after that to recertify the benefit, to recertify that you still believe they have an anticipated 6 months or less prognosis.
Okay, so let's say we have a patient who has qualified for hospice. A really common question I get is, who's going to be involved in taking care of them once they transition to hospice?
In order to be participating in the Medicare hospice benefit, you have to be providing the interdisciplinary team, which includes, you know, the physician, the nurse, social worker, bereavement, and then there are additional therapies, supplemental therapies, which, you know, we provide music therapy, art therapy, pet therapy.
Social work and nursing are the two that do the most home visits, with the nurse seeing the patient probably more so than anybody else other than a personal care aide if they have one.
Okay. So in the hospice care model, it's going to be the hospice nurse who really comes out as a frontline clinician to manage a bulk of the symptoms and medical needs. Yes, there's a physician, but they act more as a consultant. And for context, the hospice physician's overseeing multiple nurses, multiple teams, and has a pretty large caseload. So yes, if there's a specific question or ask, the physician can do a visit, but most of the time it's going to be the interdisciplinary team that's really seeing that patient in home hospice.
Right. And one of the team members we heard was a social worker who's also going to be one of the frontline clinicians, and that there's just so much that they do.
My primary job is to provide like non-medical support to patients and their families, which can be anything from making referrals to other programs, community resources, and providing like emotional support as needed. If it's not directly related to managing the illness, it's probably my job in some way, shape, or form. And like the material support that I provide, like I mentioned, it's like providing, bringing in outside resources as needed, but also like making funeral arrangements if need be, making sure that, you know, any, cultural and religious, traditions or, rites or whatever need to be honored.
Wow. So grateful to hear that there's someone on the hospice team to help with these aspects. I know the funeral and the cultural end of life traditions can be stressful for many.
Exactly. And on top of that, hospice agencies are also required to provide bereavement counselors that provide a minimum of 13 months of support to families after a patient dies. And the reason for at least 13 months? We want to support loved ones through the one-year anniversary of the patient's passing.
Wow. That's actually incredibly thoughtful.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's other team members who also support the patients, such as music therapists like Brianna.
I am a board certified music therapist. Basically, my role on the team is to work with families to use music as the medium to achieve a goal, a clinical goal of some kind. So often when I'm working with our hospice patients and their families or their advocates and their care teams, it looks any number of ways. And it's really hard to kind of make a blanket statement, but some examples of a goal that we may be working to achieve are increased opportunities for relaxation, increased quality of life and meaningful connection between family members, legacy projects. Sometimes we work with individuals to write songs about their lives, to do autobiographical work, or to do any number of things that can be emotionally processing, can be emotionally expressive.
This reminds me of a patient, guys, that I had recently who worked with a music therapist. And can I tell you, it was day and night in terms of her anxiety, her pain control. I mean, worked way better than the hydroxyzine that I prescribed.
Yeah, and that is such a testament to how therapists can really impact care. And on the other hand, on the physical help side of things, one of the most necessary people to support the patient and the family are home health aides or home care aides.
Home care aides, which is what we call our hospice aides, that's often the member of our team that families need the most. You know, helping literally with personal care and bathing, if there are continence issues and things like that. There's a huge variation of how many hours that different companies will offer, how many aid hours.
Oh, okay, so if there's this huge variation in the number of hours hospice aides can get to see patients, I know it's hard to hear that because, you know, a lot of patients do have questions and want some certainty around it. So are there any kind of rules of thumbs on how frequently the home aides can see some of these patients?
Yeah. First and foremost, I often have to counsel patients and families that hospice doesn't move into the home to provide 24/7 care. Here's Dr. Sutton's take on this.
We determine our nursing frequency visits based on the needs of the patient. I think there are some differences between organizations on how frequently visits get done. We have a spectrum of daily visits to as little as, you know, every other week. We really try to get in there once a week just because it seems to lead to better outcomes. But some people end up needing daily visits. It's common to get two or three a week. We do have many patients that are seen on the weekends as well.
Right. I also counsel that the initial transition onto hospice services, those first few days can be busy. The hospice team is trying to get symptoms settled, meet the family, get things set up.
with any transition of care, whether that's the care setting or just a new care team, it takes time to get settled and get your symptoms managed, to get things in the home, not just in the home, but set up to get everyone comfortable using it in a routine, you know, with the team, the members that you know, your aid, your medications settled, your symptoms well managed. I think some of our patients, once we're able to get in there and providing frequent nursing and getting our aid, especially at a lot of the facilities, people are able to thrive because they're getting checked on. But the families feel more supported in providing that care because they know if something goes wrong, they can reach out to us.
So when Dr. Sutton says that they can reach out to us, she means patients and families can contact the hospice at any time. Hospice agencies have a 24-hour telephone access line to provide guidance to patients and families in case symptoms or concerns arise. The hospice can provide recommendations over the phone or send a team member out like a nurse, even at 2 a.m. to evaluate the patient.
So that's really reassuring. So patients and families have a consistent point of contact for medical questions in case of concerns or emergencies, rather than families, you know, panicking and presenting straight to the hospital.
Yep. Good to have that point of contact. Okay. Last thing I'm thinking about are a lot of these patients have longstanding primary care doctors or oncologists or even really helpful consultants like the palliative care doctors like you, Harry. And I'm just curious, is once they go on to hospice, can the patient still go see these outpatient clinicians? Will that be covered?
When someone comes on hospice, on the consent form, it actually has a blank spot that is asking who they want their attending of record to be. What doctor do they currently follow with? Who they want also to follow them while in hospice. I think that the consent forms could explain this a little bit better, but what they're actually asking is, what doctor do you want to keep seeing while you're on hospice? But it is important because that doctor can bill insurance and get paid for seeing them just the same while they're on hospice. So when people are asking me what I write in there, I phrase it as, not who do you want your attending of record to be, because that wouldn't mean much to a family member or a patient. I say, which doctor do you want to keep following with while you're on hospice?
So basically, whoever the patient designates as the attending of record, that is the outpatient clinician that can bill for seeing the patient while on hospice. Now, for other outpatient clinicians who aren't the attending of record, theoretically, yes, the patients can go see those clinicians, but there's a question of who pays for that outpatient visit. So we counsel patients to speak with the hospice agencies directly before making any routine outpatient appointments.
Okay, so if I'm to summarize this, hospice mandates an interdisciplinary care team. On the front lines, you're going to have a hospice nurse and a social worker working with a clinician overseeing the process and who's there for sort of any backup. Then there are also home health aides, music therapists, as well as possibly at least one outpatient doc that the patient can continue to see.
All right, now on to the money aspects of things. I'm always humbled and surprised by some of this, so I'm curious who's going to pay for hospice and how much. Let's get into all of that.
All of the private insurance companies, as well as Medicaid, they kind of follow the Medicare guidelines. But if I'm ever referencing a guideline or a regulation, those are all specific to the Medicare hospice benefit.
Okay. So it sounds like the hospice benefit is baked into a patient's Medicare insurance benefit. But say a patient has private insurance or Medicaid, then those usually follow whatever Medicare outlines too.
Right. So when patients enroll in hospice, the hospice benefit takes over the patient's Medicare private insurance plan. The insurance pays the local hospice agencies directly for things like medications, medical equipment like oxygen tanks, commodes, hospital beds, and the team, the medical, nursing, counseling, and bereavement services.
Okay, all right. So if hospice is an insurance benefit, I'm curious, is it like a fee-for-service thing like most of outpatient U.S. healthcare, or is it something else?
We're all paid that same daily rate, and it's how you use that rate and what happens when it's left over.
What? Every agency gets paid the same no matter how complex the patient may be?
Yep. The agency receives a fixed daily rate for every patient on hospice, around $210 to $215 a day, if a patient is receiving hospice care at home. There is a fudge factor to this amount, depending where someone lives in the United States, plus minus 10 to 20%.
When you think about the physician salary, you know, the nursing visits, also paying the home care aide, there's a tremendous amount of administrative work that also goes along behind the scenes, not just processing different things, but making sure that you're keeping up with regulatory components. So we have a large admin staff thinking about all the meds that are covered that are related and required for comfort. And then any of those interventions that we're talking about, all of that gets paid for by how much you're given your daily rate by the insurance agency.
Yeah. So $210 may not be a lot when you account for the medications, the personnel, the durable medical equipment, and the administrative staff needed to deal with all the Medicare regulations.
Yeah. And what I'm really surprised by is that while Medicare provides some initial guidance, the hospice agencies ultimately decide how to use this money and also what happens if there is leftover money.
I mean, it is interesting that some places will provide much less home care 8 hours and some will provide much more, or the nursing visit frequency, again, all primarily directed, should be directed by the needs of the patient, but it's hard to know how exactly those choices are made.
Oh, no wonder there's so much variability in these hospice agencies. It sounds like it's really up to each agency about what they want to cover. All right, maybe if I'm to recap what I'm taking away, it sounds like in typical home hospice settings, and we'll get to the other settings in the next section, every patient on home hospice is allotted a little over $200 a day to pay for all things, including medications, healthcare workers, administrative staff, equipment, all the above.
And before we move on, I can't really help but connect now that I know that hospice is an insurance benefit. It makes sense why I've struggled with hospice enrollment for some of my uninsured patients. I mean, if a patient's uninsured, they're not going to have a hospice benefit.
Yeah, that part is really unfortunate. Sometimes we get lucky and a case manager calls me to tell me that a hospice agency is willing to do charity care, where they enroll someone on hospice who does not have an insurance benefit. But unfortunately, there just isn't a good safety net for uninsured patients when it comes to end-of-life care.
Yeah, so much room for improvement here. Okay, one big blind spot that I've heard both from patients, families, and I've even heard clinicians misconstrue to patients is where the hospice can actually occur.
So one big misconception that a lot of families or patients have about hospice is that we move in, that we have someone there, you know, around the clock, or that you move somewhere, I guess a hospice house, and then people are there around the clock. They don't realize that you can be on hospice services anywhere.
Yeah. And so technically speaking, there's actually four different levels of care where hospice can take place.
Right. The teaching point here is that where hospice care occurs really depends on what the hospice quote-unquote level of care is for the patient. Just like there's outpatient care and inpatient care in the traditional sense, in hospice, there's a similar distinction with each level of care having its own criteria.
So again, the majority of our patients are on routine level of hospice care, and that is care that is taking place in their home, wherever that home may be. That could be at a nursing home, at an assisted living, an independent living, a home like I'm sitting in right now. Wherever their definition of home is, we are providing care there.
Okay, so it sounds like the first level of care is routine level of care. It's going to be an interdisciplinary team coming out to see the patient wherever they live, wherever they call home, whether it's a house, if they're a long-term care resident at a nursing home, or say an assisted living facility.
Yep, routine level of care. I view it as akin to outpatient or ambulatory hospice care.
So I guess what I take away from that is that for routine level of care, the hospice team will sort of come as needed depending on the patient's medical or psychosocial needs, but they're not necessarily there around the clock for general caregiving needs like bathing and eating. For those needs, we really rely on caregivers at home or the staff at the assisted living facility or nursing home.
Right. Caregiving is such a big concern when I speak with patients and families, and we'll come back to that in a few minutes. I want to transition to the second level of care, general inpatient care, which you'll often hear abbreviated as GIP.
And then on the next layer of care, we have general inpatient care. It is a higher level of care that is required in order to manage symptoms that could not be managed in the routine home care setting. There are certain facilities, but it's easier just to think about that in terms of getting that GIP level care at a hospital or a GIP hospice facility.
So let me make this analogy to cement things. If we think of GIP as akin to acute hospital level care, then just like any hospital admission, there has to be a medical reason for GIP. For hospice, that means it's uncontrolled symptoms like pain, uncontrolled agitation at home, bad nausea and vomiting, that cannot be controlled on routine level of care, aka that outpatient level of care that happens in the home or in a SNF or an assisted living facility.
So GIP facilities and hospitals are staffed 24/7, similar to inpatient hospitals. But Dr. Sutton did caution us about how to use the term hospice facility.
So when people talk about a hospice facility, that could mean either a GIP level care or a residential level of care. So I think that it's pretty important to have a distinction between the two. There are things called residential hospice houses. That is not the GIP level of care. That is not necessarily for higher levels of care. That's just for people who that is now going to be their home. They move there and they are going to be residing there.
Okay. I guess I need to be a little bit more specific when I say hospice house to a case manager or hospice facility and specify that level of care. Is it either happening at a routine level of care or a GIP, right? Is it a patient that may be going to this dedicated hospice facility because they have severe symptoms and really warrant that GIP level of care? Or is it someone who doesn't need IV meds and that hospice facility is now their new home under that routine level of care umbrella?
We do provide aides. You have aides and you also have nursing care available around the clock to administer meds and whatnot. But that is still routine level of care, just taking place at a residential hospice facility.
So routine level of care at hospice facilities is similar to having a patient being at a SNF with aides and nurses present, but maybe not at the level or intensity as they get on GIP.
Yeah. You know, I'm still thinking about that $200 a day quote, wrapping my head around that still. And I'm just curious, you know, about those patients who are on routine level of care at a SNF or a nursing home. Is everything covered under that $200 a day umbrella?
So for routine level of care at a SNF or a residential hospice facility, hospices still receive $200 a day for all the stuff we mentioned above. And so patients often have to pay out of pocket for room and board at these facilities.
Man, that's a bummer. That brings me then to the GIP level of care. Is that also the same, you know, cookie cutter, a little over $200 a day? Hopefully it's a little bit more because it's more intense care.
Yeah. So because patients on GIP are often symptomatically sicker, potentially their death may be more imminent, and it is a higher level of care, the hospice benefit does pay the hospice agencies more for GIP. On average, about $1,100 a day, plus minus, depending on location.
But honestly, now that I think about it, even $1,100 a day is still not a lot when you think about the fact that it includes room and board and around-the-clock care.
Yeah. Huh. I'm glad we're clarifying all this. Again, this is all just so eye-opening till I actually learned the money behind this. I'm curious though, you know, once someone's enrolled in hospice, can patients transition between that routine level care and GIP care? Or do they have to be disenrolled and paperwork and headaches?
Absolutely. Patients can remain on hospice and shift between the different levels of care as the illness evolves without coming off hospice. So for example, let's say you discharge a patient from the hospital on routine level of care, and over time they develop some uncontrolled symptoms. So at that point, the hospice team can then arrange the patient to upgrade levels of care and move to a GIP-capable facility without disenrolling from hospice. Likewise, patients could start on GIP because of their uncontrolled symptoms, downgrade to routine when symptoms become controlled, and then go back on GIP if they get symptomatically sicker again as the illness evolves.
Nice. Okay. So it sounds like there's a fluidity there, which is helpful and maybe even similar to kind of how patients flow through inpatient, outpatient. Patients can do that between routine and GIP level. You did mention, though, earlier that there was two other levels of care, the total of four. Do you want to go over those real quickly?
Sure. So these last two levels of care are less relevant to internal medicine clinicians because these care decisions are usually for patients who are already enrolled on hospice. But for completeness sake, the third level of care is respite care. Respite care is short-term inpatient care provided to patients when necessary to relieve the patient's caregiver.
Oh, I'm so glad the hospice benefits cover something for respite care. Curious, how long does the caregivers get for relief?
Sure. So caregivers can receive up to 5 consecutive days where the patients go to an inpatient hospice facility, a SNF, or a hospital. So caregivers can get a break or attend life functions. Respite care is usually prearranged and approved by the hospice agency for patients already on their services.
Okay. So that makes sense why I think we don't interface with it as much. What's the fourth level of care you mentioned?
So the fourth level of care is continuous home care. And this level of care manages sort of an acute medical crisis, things like uncontrolled symptoms, as needed to maintain the patient at home. Usually this means like a nurse is consistently present in the home throughout the day to assess and manage uncontrolled symptoms. This, again, is a care decision made by the hospice agency for patients already enrolled on their services, and less likely a decision that we as internal medicine clinicians make on that initial referral.
So, Harry, if I'm to summarize, there are four levels of care where hospice can occur. The main two are either routine care that takes place where someone already lives, and then GIP level of care is for patients with uncontrolled symptoms requiring things like IV medications. GIP level of care can occur either in the hospital or at a GIP-capable healthcare facility, such as a hospice house.
Yep. And it's important to note that at a hospice house or hospice facility, patients can either be on routine level of care or GIP.
And there's going to be a great infographic from Dr. Jesse Powell that kind of goes over all this, and I'm definitely going to be pulling it up on rounds. And it also has, for me, the most eye-opening thing, which is, you know, how hospice pays for this. And for routine level of care, it's going to be a little bit over $200 a day for any patient on routine level of care, and then a little over $1,100 a day for GIP level of care. And yes, that $1,100 a day does include room and board, thankfully by the hospice benefit. On the other hand, if, say, our patient qualifies for routine level of care, but they need to be at a SNF or a hospice facility, then unless they have some other type of insurance, then they likely have to pay out of pocket for that room and board.
In addition, there's respite care for patients already enrolled on hospice to give caregivers a break for up to 5 days, and continuous home care for patients on hospice who are experiencing an acute medical crisis.
So let's close things out with a few limitations of that hospice Medicare benefit.
You know, one of the things I always struggle with is when my patients who are imminent don't quite qualify for GIP level of care in the hospital.
Yeah, same. You know, tons of family being like, no, please don't move my dying family member. Can we please keep them in the hospital? They're so frail. And these are just like tough, gut-wrenching conversations because they are all such reasonable asks and requests, and I definitely feel stuck.
We'll get referrals that a patient is dying. You know, can we quick admit them to hospice? And while I see all the benefits of coming on hospice, such as the support for the family, maybe bereavement services, support groups, and things like that, if you don't meet the criteria for GIP level of care, it's not really appropriate to just admit people to hospice because they're dying in the hospital. So it really is determined by if they have symptoms that need to be managed in the hospital. That is how we really determine if we can do a GIP admission. A lot of dying is quite peaceful, a lot of the dying process. So if someone is peacefully, asymptomatically dying in the hospital, they wouldn't really meet criteria to be admitted to hospice in that hospital setting. And that is hard because the families will say, but they're dying. And hospitals will also say to us, but they're dying. And it's just stuff we have to justify why we can't care for that patient at home. You really need to have symptoms that cannot be managed in the routine home care setting.
This all hits hard and speaks to that larger issue with hospice, which is caregiving. I think so many patients have high caregiving needs, and it's a lot to fall on one person's shoulder. And on top of that, there's so many patients that we have who don't even have any caregivers, right? Or can't afford nursing homes, and at the same time, don't meet that GIP level of care.
The weakness of the Medicare benefit is that it assumes that there's a care network in place. The assumption that there is going to be family in the home. When Good Shepherd got started, the primary illnesses that, you know, people had when they came on were like cancer, and they were already, you know, actively at the end of life. You know, there was like a short period of time on services, and it was different. You know, you would have to, you know, families, or even if it was just one or two caregivers, you know, there would be an intense few weeks and then it would be over. Now we have like patients that are like on for services for a lot longer than they historically were when like the benefit got created.
Wow. Things have certainly evolved, especially with all the medical advances that we have, and the hospice benefit has yet to catch up to all the gaps. And sure, hospice does cover the medical aspects of care, which we're going to definitely get into more in episode 2. But the things that most patients and families need is caregiving, right? Custodial support for bathing, eating, other things around the house, things that are not covered 24/7.
We do our best. And that's where part of my job is to arrange for that outside the home care. But you're talking private pay caregivers at that point in time, and not everybody can afford it. Even though they're not paid nearly as much enough for the work that they do, it still adds up very, very quickly when you're talking, you know, 24/7 or even 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, 40 hours a week. You know, that adds up. When they come to us, you know, what we offer is we can offer you this. And then here's this list of agencies that you can hire, but know that it could cost up to $30 an hour for a block of 8 hours. So
$30 an hour? That's even more than many childcare professionals.
I imagine that's why sometimes people consider becoming home health aides for their loved ones, just to be compensated and to make this whole thing more affordable.
Yeah. Sadly, it's up to the patient's family to set up caregiving, or they have to pay out of pocket for hired help at home, or they have to figure out whether their insurance does cover room and board at a nursing home, or ultimately pay out of pocket if they have to go to a SNF or assisted living facility.
This is just so much cognitive load. I really, really feel for our patients here.
Like when it comes to caregivers, like that's from a social work perspective, that's like, you know, the big deal is like caregiver burnout because there's just not enough, especially the dementia patients. When we have, like, I have a patient, our kids have like, I don't know how many times that they can mortgage a single property, but they've done it to keep her at home. But it's not uncommon to have patients that are on for, you know, a long, lengthy period of time. And that, you know, like in even with our support, emotionally exhausting, especially with somebody who has, you know, dementia that goes from having conversations to not being able to say anything or is actively confused and personality changes. And, you know, you're seeing somebody, their personality dies before their body dies, you know, like their personhood dies before their body dies.
Wow, that is such an intense process for any person, let alone a family member who not only is processing the fact that their loved one is at the end of life, but then also having to do all this heavy lifting and providing the day-to-day care.
Yeah, I'm so glad we're doing this episode and giving all this a voice, because I don't know about you guys, I definitely feel a sense of like moral distress telling people how great hospice is and hyping it up, but of course, it comes with its limitations, and hopefully this episode will help all of us prep our patients better for, yes, all the good things that come with hospice and how it might be really the right next step for a patient, but also be real about all the gaps like caregiving, especially if that loved one qualifies for a routine level of care.
You know, after this discussion, I just want to close out with a quote that Brianna Tobin said about how hospice is really more about life and not about death. And, you know, that to me is the true value of hospice. And I just really love how she frames this.
Hospice is not just about death. It is about life. And it is about making sure that your last months, days with your person of significance are really meaningful, and to really advocate to get the most out of your hospice care, and to really think about not closing the door on a therapy or a service that is offered because you're not sure of it, but to ask a lot of questions. And then to also say that hospice is not something to be afraid of, and that we are, as a hospice practitioner, I promise I will not bite.
And on that note, that is a wrap for today's episode. Please share this episode with a colleague or anyone else who might find this episode helpful. There's also a really beautiful behind-the-scenes YouTube interview that Harry did with Brianna Tobin that is just absolute gold.
And thank you to our reviewers, Dr. Helen Knight, Mara Feingold-Link, and Charlotte Grinberg.
Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliate institutions. Thank you. Take care.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get 15% off a set of Brake Best Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.